Good morning. We're going to turn that down. Representative Dave Pinto, the chair of the Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy Committee, along with my co-chair, Representative Dave Baker, calling this meeting to order. Welcome to members. Welcome to members of the public who are joining us as well. Members, today we have got six bills on the agenda. The particular highlight is a presentation by two of the larger departments that we oversee regarding their budget presentation. And so we'll have quite a bit of discussion on that. Also a couple of bills from Representative Greenman, which we're going to do first because she needs to be in another committee at 9 a.m., and then two more bills as well. I don't know if there are questions anybody has about the agenda, not seeing anything. We're going to go to the minutes, and so I'll seek a motion for approval or minutes of our March 25th meeting. Anybody wish to do that? Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, so move.
Chair Baker moves approval or minutes for March 25th. I will note, Chair Baker and all, I think there's a typo on the back page under House File 1671. It should be that the A1 amendment was moved and adopted. And so with that,
so move as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So any other additions or corrections to those minutes? Hearing none, all in favor of approval of those March 25th minutes to be moved as amended, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion passes. Those minutes are approved. Thank you, Chair Baker. Thanks all. So again, we're going to have a couple bills from Representative Greenman up first, and then she'll be heading off to another committee, which is why we're doing it in this order. Representative Greenman moves House File 2146 to be before us. And both these bills, the plan, members, is to hear them, lay them over for possible discussion another day. And Representative Greenman, I know you've got an amendment here. Do you want to move that at the start as well? I guess it's a DE1, so correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move the DE1 amendment. This is it does the same things. It is just that the agencies have been working to make sure that it is operable and works for them. And so I want to move it to get it in the shape I'd like it.
Okay. So Representative Greenman moves the DE1 amendment to the House File 2146. Any discussion to that, members? Hearing none, all in favor of approval of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. So the motion passes. Representative Greenman, the bill is in the shape that you wish, and so please begin to present your bill. And before you begin, maybe I'll note my understanding, Representative Greenman, the plan is for you to essentially describe both bills now, so we'll have a full discussion, and then we will bring up House File 2145 just briefly to bring it before us, but the two bills, I guess, we'll discuss as a package. And if members have questions about that as we go along, obviously raise that. Representative Greenman, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the both of these bills come out of the task force, the Attorney General's Task Force on Misclassification, are intended to strengthen our efforts to prevent misclassification fraud and the impact it has on our public coffers and on workers. There are two different bills here today. I think the testifiers will probably be focused on both bills. If when we get to the deed penalties, folks have additional detailed questions, that's the next bill. The first bill we're going to start with is a bill that ensures that we are actually measuring the problem of misclassification and its impact both on our taxpayer dollars and on the programs and the public and the workers. They come as a larger set of recommendations. They may be in your packet. If not, we can make sure you have them. They're on the Attorney General's website. From a task force that spent 14 months, probably hundreds of hours, learning from workers, businesses, Minnesota's law enforcement entities at the local and state level who deal with wage theft, who deal with these public programs, trying to understand how this problem of misclassification fraud impacts workers and businesses. And what we found is it's a huge problem and it's only growing. We talked about that a lot last year in the Labor Committee. But we also learned how hard it was to measure the problem and what it's costing taxpayers as well as our workers. And just the 20 seconds, I will not repeat everything in this binder, but for folks who are not familiar with the issue of misclassification fraud, it's when an employer illegally treats a worker as an independent contractor when they should be legally an employee. When you're an employee, you get minimum wage and overtime pay. As an independent contractor, you don't. You get access to unemployment insurance if you get laid off. You get workers' compensation if you get hurt at work, you get paid time off to care, and your employer pays half the payroll taxes. And if you want to form a union or if you're discriminated against at work, you have those laws that protect you. When you are an independent contractor, it's just under contract law. None of those laws apply to you. So there are freelancers and self-employed folks in the task force. We heard from a lot of them. They are in business for themselves. They negotiate their terms, their payments, their scope of the contract, and they build a book of business. Those are not the folks we're talking about. Those are treated as independent contractors under the law, and there's not an issue there. But the impact of misclassification fraud is not just on workers. We spent a lot of time last year talking about how it impacts workers. It also steals from our public programs, like unemployment insurance, the Workforce Development Fund, specifically in this committee, also payroll taxes and other things. And it cheats taxpayers out of the hundreds of millions of dollars that are intended for these programs. It can also impact law-abiding businesses that are following the law, that are classifying workers in the right way by forcing them to compete against companies that are underbidding artificially and illegally reducing their costs by cheating their workers and by cheating the taxpayer and the taxpayer programs out of what they should be paying, what the law requires them to pay. So that's the problem. It's a problem I've been working on for years. In the 2007, the OLA said it was a problem. I got myself on the OLA commission in 2023 in order to partially to get an audit, which we got in 2024. And one of the things that it said is, one, it's a problem, and two, it's hard to measure. They didn't have the tools to actually produce an estimate of how it was impacting government. So the UI Trust Fund, the Workforce Development Fund, payroll taxes, and others. They recommended that we should direct the agencies to calculate the misclassification rate on an ongoing basis. That's what this bill does. And I'll just note a few other things about the other bill, House File 2146. What that does is it brings in line.
I think you mean 2145, by the way, just to say.
Oh,
the first one. So 2145 is the second bill.
2145 is the.
2146 is the.
Okay. 2146 is the bill I just talked about. 2145. Yep. What it does is bring deeds penalties in line with some of the other changes we made last year. Also a recommendation of the OLA report, because what they said is based on where the penalties are at, deed is basically when they find misclassification, rarely assessing penalties. And so that was something, it's a bit of a cleanup as I see it, from the work we did last year to make sure that we are deterring and preventing, and when it is caught, that there are real penalties so the folks don't just bake it into doing the price of doing business. With that, Mr. Chair, our first testifier is part of this bill presentation, I'd say, is an organization that tried to get an estimate of the impacts of worker cost of creation fraud, presented for a whole hearing at our worker misclassification task force this summer. And I will ask for Jake Schweitzer to join us.
Yeah, please make your way up. As Mr. Schweitzer does, members, I'll just point out a couple things. There's a bill summary in your packet that is House File 2146 as introduced. That's actually an error because, of course, we adopted the DE1. Mr. Reese is sending around to everybody the updated document. That is, and we'll have it on the website as well for members of the public, that is the correct summary. So apologies for that. And then also just to note for folks as you're settling in, Mr. Schweitzer, that a reminder that we had heard a presentation a couple weeks ago under Chair Baker from DLI regarding their, it was a presentation that we had ordered done related to misclassification. So this is sort of a follow-up on that. We had some of the groundwork laid. I remember Chair Baker saying at the time, this is something we want to get back to, and so here's a chance for us to do so. Mr. Schweitzer, please identify yourself and begin with your testimony.
Hi, good morning, Chair Pinto, Co-Chair Baker, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Jake Schweitzer, and I'm the Executive Director of North Star Policy Action. I think I'm plugged in correctly here. I'm not sure.
Yeah, we'll see if we can get that make that happen. So we want your PowerPoint going, so we'll see if we can get some help in having that happen.
Okay. I'll just kick off as we talk here. Okay. So I'm here today, as Representative Greenman discussed, to discuss a report that we released last September in which we put forward the first statewide estimate of the cost of worker misclassification in Minnesota. I want to make three points that we derived from that report. First, worker misclassification is costly. Working Minnesotans lost billions of dollars in compensation, while the state government loses over $1 billion in revenue annually due to worker misclassification. That lost revenue ultimately costs other taxpayers who must foot the bill to make up for that gap. Second, the cost of worker misclassification fraud can be estimated. While we believe our analysis is strong, we also recognize it suffers from some limitations, primarily due to a lack of access to more comprehensive state data sources. A more accurate and comprehensive analysis requires state data and resources. And those two points combine to inform the third. It is worth it for the state to invest more resources in measuring misclassification fraud, given its high price tag. Minnesota devotes substantially more money to deal with problems that are far less costly than worker misclassification fraud. To take these points each in turn, our analysis found that approximately 316,000 individuals, or 9.4% of all private sector workers, experienced misclassification fraud in 2019. I should note here that we rely on 2019 data because it was the most recent year with available data. These 316,000 workers lost between $2.9 and $6.2 billion in compensation through losses such as unrealized overtime pay and the lack of health care and retirement benefits. Notably, these numbers are almost assuredly an undercount of the true scale of this problem, as we utilize conservative assumptions throughout our analysis. For example, this cost to workers does not include certain Minnesota-specific benefits, such as earned sick and safe time, nor does it include workers' lost access to discrimination protections. Finally, we assume workers experiencing misclassification fraud are paid the same as their wage and salary peers, an assumption that is not likely to be true.
Mr. Schweitzer, I just want to note for members, I'm not seeing your presentation in our packets, but it is online under, it says HF 2145 and HF 2146 presentation. Maybe other people have the physical copy. I don't have it, but it is online. I can see Representative Mueller has it up. So please continue. Just want to direct everybody's attention. Thanks.
Thank you. Misclassification fraud also carries a high price tag to the government, as they lose out on revenue they would have otherwise collected for programs like unemployment insurance and workers' compensation. We estimate that Minnesota state government lost between $506 million and $1.3 billion due to misclassification fraud in 2019. Again, this estimate does not include Minnesota-specific benefits, suggesting the true cost is greater. This lost revenue ultimately puts the government into the position of either having to slash government services or make up for this gap by shifting the burden onto other taxpayers. Put simply, we all suffer the cost of misclassification fraud. As for point two, it's important to note that misclassification fraud is a problem that can be estimated. We've seen some state efforts in this direction through past OLA audits, but our report provides the first estimate of the statewide cost of this issue. While we have confidence in our analysis, we followed procedures from past studies and drew on a range of robust federal government sources. We also see several limitations in a state relying on a think tank such as ourselves to produce these estimates. In particular, a more accurate and comprehensive analysis would utilize state data that we don't have access to, would include state-specific benefits, and would be able to avoid several of the conservative assumptions we undertook. While we recognize that engaging in such an analysis would require more resources from the state, we ultimately believe those resources are well motivated by the scale of this problem. So if we compare worker misclassification fraud to other problems that the state seeks to address, we get a better sense of the scale. Consider shoplifting, an issue that has gained a lot of attention from the state in recent years. In 2022, Minnesota businesses lost out on $1.45 billion in revenue due to theft, while the state lost $100 million in sales tax dollars due to that theft. While these are large numbers, they're dwarfed by the cost of worker misclassification for both the state and its victims, meaning working Minnesotans. Auto theft provides another reference point. According to a 2018 report, approximately 10,073 vehicles were stolen, with a total price tag of $39 million for vehicles that were not recovered. To deal with this issue, Minnesota invested $3.1 million into its auto theft prevention grant program in 2024. Our intention is not to downplay the severity of auto theft or the importance of providing state resources to deal with it, but rather to highlight that the scale of worker misclassification seems to call for similar investments. Ultimately, this analysis leads us to two final points. First, while we've done our best to estimate the cost of this problem in Minnesota, we firmly believe a more comprehensive and superior analysis necessitates state resources and state data. While this will carry a price tag, that price tag should ultimately be weighted against the amount of money that the state could recover through currently unrealized revenue, as well as money that the state spends to deal with other issues like auto theft. Second, we should recognize the value of a state-run analysis not only through its accuracy, but also its capacity for accountability. This analysis can better inform enforcement efforts and will allow the state to investigate if those enforcement efforts are actually working. Only an annual state analysis will provide the ability to evaluate any changes to the scale of misclassification fraud caused by new state policies to deal with this problem. If we want to hold government accountable for dealing with fraud, we need an accurate understanding of what that fraud looks like and what is working to address it. Thank you, and I look forward to any questions you may have.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We'll move on to other testifiers then. Chair Baker, please. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And just a quick question to the testifier. I know because we have other things. Who is North Star Policy?
Yeah.
Who are you and how are you supported? I hear that name a lot in the reports, but I don't know. I've never heard you before. So,
yeah, Mr. Schweitzer.
Thank you for the question, Co-Chair Baker. We are a two-person team as of now. Myself, executive director, and Aaron Rosenthal is our research director, a PhD, former college professor, much smarter than I am. And we are supported by a coalition of labor unions, employers, other folks interested in supporting our work, which is researching and communicating policies that can support working Minnesotans.
Thank you.
Chair Baker. Okay. All right. And thank you, Mr. Schweitzer. So moving on to Jesse Madison. You can make your way up, and maybe I'll ask Alana Olson to do so as well, just so we'll be able to keep things moving efficiently. And as you go up there again, members, the plan is we're having testimony on both bills. I'll end up asking the public on both bills as well, and have a discussion on both bills just to sort of keep things efficient here. So, Jesse Madison, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chairman, Co-Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jesse Madison. I'm the founder and CEO of Purple Tally Productions, Incorporated. We're based here in Bloomington, Minnesota. I want to first off sincerely thank Representative Greenman and the task force for including me on this important work you're doing here today. I'm here to speak out in support of HF 2146. Since 2014, my company has worked to provide staffing, payroll, and production expertise in live sports and entertainment. So if you're at home watching Twins, Timberwolves, Wild, University of Minnesota, Minnesota United, a lot of those workers are our employees. Thankfully, we have a strong union force. Companies know not to screw around in Minnesota because the union will come after and prove their jurisdiction. We've unionized pretty much, I would say, 80 to 90% of the workforce because they wanted union representation, not because we forced it on them. So in Minnesota, we have it easy as far as sports go. With everything else, live entertainment, corporate production, that's where the problem comes in. There's too many cowboy employers out there willing to do everything 1099. When they do that, they can undercut us by 30 to 40% if we're lucky. We can't compete. We lose those jobs. I lose hundreds of thousands of dollars of work every single year because these companies don't care. It's just like speeding through the part of your neighborhood where you know there's no cops. You're going to do it because you're not worried about getting caught. Neither are they. It's getting tougher for them now thanks to the work of Representative Greenman and the DLI and everybody else. It's getting tougher, but they're still not scared. There's still work to do. I have to carry tens of thousands of dollars of insurance because people do get hurt on the job. If it's on my job, then that's my insurance policy. If it's on a company that's willing to just cowboy it and do 1099, they don't pay anything. It's on the worker. There's people you'll probably hear from today or you've heard from in the past. They get injured at work. It ruins their career. It takes them years to recover. So I want to see some action around this. I want to see this thing improved. There's a lot we can do. And I saw some great comparisons up there. You've seen some shoplifting and auto theft. There was a lot of energy put behind that to fix it. These numbers are bigger, and it's hitting a lot of companies like mine. This is my fifth committee. I've heard a lot of opposition to things like, oh, the laws are too hard to figure out for small companies. I know you don't know me, but I'll let you in on a secret. I am not a Rhodes Scholar. I'm a public school product. I went to 2 years of tech school and started a company later. It's not too hard to figure out. There's a lot of great help. In fact, when you call the state, they are incredibly helpful. When you call and say, hey, I don't know exactly how to pay the sales tax and this Department of Revenue, they'll spend all kinds of time with you. So I don't accept a lot of the opposition's points that they make and why we can't do this. We can. If we do it, we're going to have an even playing ground. I don't mind losing work when the playing ground is level. But losing it because somebody's willing to cheat and they know they won't get caught, I've had enough of that. I have 14 people on staff. We have thousands of people as freelancers in our database. And the only way I'm going to keep those people going is if I get a fair playing ground. And that's that's all for me. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much for sharing your experience and your testimony. Appreciate it. So Alana Olson, and then Tony McGarvey, if you can make your way up. But Alana Olson, please identify yourself. Proceed.
Good morning. As you just heard, my name is Alana Olson. I'm a proud member of IATSE Local 13, and I've spent 20 years working backstage in live entertainment. It is that experience in this industry that made me obsessed with misclassification. In 2012, a workplace accident caused my heel to shatter into 100 pieces. The convention that I had worked for 4 summers in a row claimed that they, quote, had no employees. They didn't have workman's comp either. It was because of this event that I realized that worker classification matters. I knew that sometimes there were different forms, a 1099 or a W-2, but I didn't understand why. They didn't teach you about that in school. I was on bed rest and crutches for 6 months and unable to accept work from my 22 employers and half a dozen 1099 jobs that I had been earning a living from. Filing for unemployment was an impossible task because I could not answer how many days per month do you work for this employer? 3 years after my injury, I still couldn't work for half of the employers that I used to. My foot couldn't handle more than an 8-hour day, concrete floors, round rung ladders, or ramps. To this day, I have a partial permanent disability. At the time of my injury, I was doing the same work that I do at all of those other jobs. I arrive when the trucks pull into the dock and leave after they drive off or when the audience files out of the auditorium. I work at the employer's venue with the employer's tools, building from the employer's drawings. I get paid the hourly wage that the employer tells me is available. Sometimes I work for them a few weeks straight, several days every few months, or just an overnight here and there during the busy season. Be it lighting or carpentry or sound, theaters and event companies wouldn't have an event without it. The story of my injury and recovery is not unique. The work we do is dangerous and likely to cause acute or repetitive injury. The unique part is what I did with what I learned about worker classification. In another example, there was an opera company that rented Guthrie equipment and hired Guthrie staff as independent contractors to work in dangerous conditions. For 4 years, the stagehands begged the organization to classify them as employees. The executive director, who was a lawyer, by the way, said, quote, she could not afford, despite a $150,000 budget per show. At the opera company, my community wasn't willing to wait for someone to get seriously injured in order to prove a point. We reached out to the state for help. The Department of Labor explained that the only route we had to report misclassification was if they had broken one of the employee guaranteed rights, like minimum wage or overtime. Additionally, the number of workers affected in this case was, quote, pretty small and, quote, probably not worth the government's resources. We did report to the IRS that the spotlight operators weren't making minimum wage, but they never responded. And finally, at a request, the Special Compensation Fund wrote a letter to the company, but it had no teeth. Our government outreach went absolutely nowhere, and it was really disheartening. The good news in all of this is that misclassification in theater in the Twin Cities has noticeably declined over the last 12 years after a huge internal and totally volunteer-run campaign to get the word out. Today, lots more theater organizations classify stagehands as employees. Universities teach theater kids about 1099s and W-2s, and the workers themselves know their rights and are insisting on them. Minnesota depends on the health and sustainability of its thriving event industry. Although the Twin Cities theater scene has made great progress, concerts and corporate events, and the whole rest of the state isn't like that. You'll find even more misclassification and resistance in those sectors.
And I'll need to have you wrap up just a second if you can, because I need to move on.
Yeah. The point that everyone is missing is that you don't get to choose your classification. The law determines it. But the law is ambiguous, complicated, and not written with any understanding of my industry. Most theater executives want to do right by their workers, but there are bad bosses out there. What the government provides for workers right now in situations like those I've described are not enough to address the problem or protect vulnerable workers from those who work whose work is the pride of Minnesota.
Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for your testimony. And Tony McGarvey, please identify yourself. Proceed.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, Co-Chair Baker, and members of the committee. My name is Tony McGarvey. I live in House District 38A, Brooklyn Park, Minnesota, where I also happen to serve on the City Council. This is an important conversation we're having here because as Americans, whether we have an R or a D behind our name, I believe we all want the same thing, and that's a strong economy. I'm a painter by trade, a member of the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 82, Local 386, Minneapolis Painters and Tapers. I worked in the field as a journeyman painter for approximately 14 years before being asked to come on as a union agent and organizer with my union in 2015. In addition to my role here as an industry representative, I testify today as a middle-class, tax-paying citizen of the United States. At the Painters Union, our efforts originated in and focused primarily on the harm done to workers by what we were discovering. It soon became evident that it also impacted the law-abiding employers our members worked for. The small business owners in our communities who carry a payroll, pay the employer's share of Social Security taxes, workers' compensation, unemployment insurance, overtime, undergirding our economy and maintaining our social safety nets. I was first exposed to worker misclassification and insurance fraud at the end of 2016 when we discovered that we had lost 160 members almost overnight. We learned that three of our largest drywall finishing contractors had experienced I-9 audits, and some of their workers just vanished. We later discovered many of these former members working for $100 to $120 a day, 10 to 12 hours a day, for labor brokers who supply manpower to low-road contractors. When we asked why these workers would leave a $34 an hour job for a $10 an hour job doing the exact same work, we realized that for some of them it was just safer to be underground, leaving them vulnerable to exploitation. When we asked ourselves how were they even able to get onto the job sites, we began to focus on workers' compensation fraud. Minnesota state law requires all workers on commercial construction sites to be covered by a valid workers' compensation insurance policy. And we knew they weren't buying their own policies. If you Google workers' comp fraud, the leading results refer to workers attempting to cheat the system. But if you keep digging, you'll discover that workers' comp fraud by employers is an even greater problem. In fact, it's currently part of a growing business model here in Minnesota.
And I'll probably have to have you wrap up in just a minute if I can, yeah.
So, excuse me.
sorry to throw you.
Getting old.
Yeah.
The point of my testimony here today is the fact that low-road employers utilize this business model, and by doing so, they're double-crossing the American people. Due to their lack of conscience, their greed, their willingness to traffic in an exploitable workforce, they can underbid legitimate employers, those small business owners in our communities who carry a payroll. This criminal business model, and it affects our entire economy because this is replicable in any industry. I'll end there. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thanks for your testimony. Yeah, and thank you. Thanks for your fellow elected service, too, as a city council member. Thank you. Anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify on either of these bills, which, again, we're kind of reviewing at the same time, just for efficiency's sake? Not seeing that, so then we'll close testimony. So questions, discussion from members, possibly. I see Representative Schultz. We'll go to you and go to the – yeah, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just for clarity's sake, are we talking about both bills, one bill?
Yeah,
what are we working
thank
on
you,
right
Ms. now? Thank you, Representative Schultz. Yeah, so the plan is to discuss both yeah, that is the plan. It just seems like the efficient way to go. So Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I'm looking, I guess we'll then talk a little bit, for starters, more so about 2145. this bill, and I guess first I'll just kind of ask to the author, Mr. Chair, this bill looks a lot like the worker misclassification bill from last session. So Representative Greenman, how is this bill different? And if it's not any different, why this bill now?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Schultz, as someone who's part of this conversation. This bill, what it does is I consider it cleanup because this is about deed statutes. Most of the penalty increases that we looked at and the places in response to the OLA audit that said part of the reason that we are having a hard time with enforcing is because folks are just baking it into the cost of doing business. And as you know, misclassification is both an issue usually. When you misclassify someone, you have an issue at DLI with wage and hour statutes. You also have an issue at deed with unemployment statutes, unemployment insurance statutes. You may have an issue at DOR. When we went back and looked at DOR had already had, the Department of Revenue has already has pretty strong penalties when it comes to finding and looking at misclassification. Deed's penalties are pretty low, and the OLA audit actually recommended taking a look at it. We didn't do that piece of it last year, and so that's why this is coming this year.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little bit surprised that that didn't move last year, considering the fact that, frankly, there was very little actual debate or even any amount of working together to try and solve a lot of these challenges, which has left us with a lot of uncertainty. So then I guess taking this question the next way, you know, this worker misclassification has only been implemented since March 1st of this year. There's a lawsuit pending over its constitutionality on the federal level. And so I'm curious, you know, I'm honestly curious in part, Mr. Chair, like why we're hearing this bill today when we have a whole slew of other bills that the committee has before us. But more importantly, the way that I understand this bill, Representative Greenman, is that just based upon the rules that you cite, the two different sections in 2145, Minnesota Rules 33.15, and then Minnesota Rules 5200 with additional points after that. That has the potential to be largely far more expansive and impact far greater industries than what I believe your work a year ago was targeted towards, which from my understanding and even from the testimony today was about the construction industry. Can you answer that?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, two of the three testifiers we heard today were not from construction. And just a few clarifications on the bill for folks who didn't hear it. The bill we passed last year, a piece, the construction test, went into effect in March. Lots of those pieces went into effect almost a year ago. So a lot of that bill, the partnership that we created that brings all the agencies together, they've been working since July, so maybe not quite a year ago, July or August, when we heard their report. That was a legally required report that we spent 30 minutes on about how they are looking at enforcement. So all of that stuff has been in effect for a while. And I can't speak to the litigation strategy of the biggest businesses who, when they can't win in the court of public opinion, they go to court. I have complete faith that that's going to, that like many of the other cases we've seen as it relates to our labor and economic reforms will not go anywhere. But I can't stop people from suing, and they keep lawyers employed. As it relates to this piece, this is about bringing up and dealing with the thing that we heard in the 2007 OLA audit, the thing that we heard in the 2024 OLA audit. And we actually do have a problem across the economy. Construction is where we've been working on it the longest, partially because of the 2007 audit. It is growing rapidly across the economy, which is part of what the other bill is about. We need real data on how this is impacting both workers, but also our public programs. In this body, we spend a lot of time talking about the fraud and how we are losing resources to folks who are not following the law. That is what both of these bills are about. One is about deterrence, the bill you referenced, and then the other one is about actually getting a real concrete understanding of where we're losing resources, how, so we can better enforce the law.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a lot to respond to, and obviously a great deal of deep conversation that needs to take place on this. You know,
that's why these are being laid over.
I come to this table both as the grandson of a painter. I come to this table as an independent contractor myself, and I'm concerned, Representative Greenman, that your bill somehow is going to literally eradicate subcontracting in our state. Is that the goal?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I said before, there are lots of freelancers and solo businesses. We heard hours of testimony, and it is all online if you want to go look at it, the Attorney General's task force, from independent contractors and freelancers. And they talked about the business model they set up. They talked about setting up the independent businesses where they keep track of their own profits and losses, where they, when they enter into contracts, they are contracts that they can make money from. They can build their book of business. That's not what we're talking about here. That is a contracts law issue. What we're talking about is most of the economy, when somebody works for someone else, they are an employer. Somebody is making resources off of them, and we have set up our economy that way. We could have made a different decision 80 years ago, but we didn't. And so what we're talking about right now is the law is protective of those folks who are actually solo operators of their business. And we got a very good look at what that looks like. That's not what we're talking about now. And with the bills that you're talking about, this just simply increases penalties for misrepresentation and for employer misconduct. And so if we're not penalizing misrepresentation and employer misconduct, we're not punishing and frankly have penalties that coincide with what government is losing in terms of fraud, I don't know what we're doing here.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that there's plenty of other comments around the table. I would just say that, you know, I know that underneath this Capitol dome, there is bipartisan concern for the fact that this is a duplicative penalty that could put plenty of people out of business, and I have great concern for that. And that's a bipartisan concern.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Representative Greenman, I'm going to turn to Senator Chair Baker. I don't think it's anybody else. Chair Baker, to you.
Thank you. Again, sort of echoing some of these things. Representative Greenman, I agree that we've got some bad players out there. We've talked about this offline. You know, being a dishwasher as a 1099 employee is not right. That's not what that is intended to do. The theater testimony we heard today, I understand that. There are some folks probably coming in from outside Minnesota running a show, running a theater that doesn't understand maybe fully the Minnesota laws. My concern is this is not a time for us to be looking at any kind of new penalties and new things to put against businesses with so much that has been happening and with other mandates coming. Again, I'm fearful that this is going to be overreached. And again, the fear is we need some flexibility for employers. Not saying for a second we don't want to get rid of the bad players that are taking advantage of the laws. My question is, again, you mentioned Department of Labor, Deed, Revenue. As a small employer myself, I report every single year all my 1099s. The departments have all kinds of information about these businesses under my business name, under who's the 1099s. What are they doing with that? Because then in Ms. Olson's case, her name would have showed up as a 1099. And that looks a little bit odd because she's not an LLC or she's not whatever. They need to look at this. So I guess my question is, before we dive into a lot more rules and a lot more penalties, I want to make sure the agencies are doing everything they can, and they've got the authority to do some penalizing if they see gross misconduct already. Why don't we just deal with the rules already in place? Why do we have to expand this so much? Because they're getting the information now. We have to report 1099s. And if it's folks that are getting paid cash and there is no paper trail, then what are the agencies doing about that? Those are the kind of things that I want to make sure we've got the time at some point to really dive into. And maybe we do this after committee deadline and we do some informational hearings, but I want to make sure that we focus on that part of what do we have in place now to make sure that we are not taking advantage of employees that really clearly should be W-2 employees versus 1099. So there's a big difference about how this is rolling along in a certain way. So maybe I'll just ask that. And then
yeah.
I have one follow-up.
Sure, no, I'll definitely come back to you, Chair, of course. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Chair Baker, and I appreciate the conversations we've had about this. That's part of why we had to have a task force, because frankly, we don't have enough committee time to spend all the time exploring this. That's why we had 14 months really looking at, and the agencies were on those, both deed, DLI, and revenue. That's also why we have this partnership that we created of these entities who are actually meeting on a monthly basis, and why we got the update. But to the point, so there's a penalties piece, but to the point about having more information, I agree with you. That's why actually we have this, I want this biennial report, is that whether what the OLA said is like they can't estimate the all cash economy. And what we heard from researchers is there are ways to do that and to estimate it. And that's what this report bill does. It says we want to know the number of workers experiencing misclassification. We want to know the cost that's impacted. We want to know the industries where it's happening. We want to know how it's impacting and costing the UI Trust Fund, state income tax collection, the Workers' Compensation Fund, the Workforce Development Fund. So that's what this is actually giving us more data. And the reason that it is due before the 2027 session is they think they need more than a year, but we actually need this to have this conversation. They have lots of information, but right now there is no Department of Misclassification. There's DLI, who has some information. There is deed and revenue, and particularly revenue, who has more information. What this bill does is say, we're going to make sure that we get the information the legislature needs in order to have this conversation to protect both the folks who are doing it right. And we've heard from these small businesses, but I've heard from a lot of small businesses, and frankly, normal business, the bigger businesses, that if you are playing by the rules, you're at a competitive disadvantage, and we never want to set that up. And I know we share that opinion.
And Chair Baker, back to you.
Again, I think that just generally, bottom line for me anyway, in this committee and our work that we need to do is, we don't know what the information is, but I bet the agencies do if they just start talking to each other and get out of their silos and figure out what is each one doing. When I'm hearing agencies don't have the resources to do enforcement, that's a colossal failure on the government's part. And that's what I've heard in testimony before, is that they don't have the resources to do that. And I just don't buy that. We give them money for this. They should be allocating that all the time. That's why we have $600+ million in fraud going on right now. And this is a huge issue. So we've got to make sure that this kind of thing is front and center for the agencies, that revenue, deed, labor, they've got to really make sure. And again, I'm just kind of curious also, why was the AG's office removed and Commerce removed from your initial report, your initial bill?
Representative Greenman.
With the amendment. Yes.
Thank you. They weren't removed. What we did was looked at the agencies that have the data. So the partnership, those five agencies are part of the misclassification partnership, but the places that have, the AG doesn't have any data that one of these three, that one of these three departments doesn't give them. The Department of Commerce Workers' Compensation, which fraud unit, which is now being rolled into the BCA, doesn't have data that they're not getting from these three other agencies. So this is really focused on where the information is. This is a project of the partnership, which includes those five entities.
Chair Baker?
Just the final, again, I know the AG's office, though, has the law enforcement behind it. If they need to use that, I think they should be part of that conversation and should not be removed. I also think we just need to make sure our agencies come to us with a plan of how they can address this without more fees for studies, without more penalties to businesses. I think we can do a better job trying to get to what you're trying to get to. And again, all of us, we don't want to have people that are misrepresented. We want to make sure that all of them play by the same rules. And it's frustrating for someone like me who has done that for so many years with all the paperwork, the 1099s. Every quarter, I have to report every single new employee to the department just to make sure that our unemployment is tying up and our workers' comp is tying up. The information is in front of these agencies, and I want to make sure before we do any more spending that we look to see what the agencies can do better to get to this bottom of this problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to send things back to Representative Greenman. Just before I do, I just want to note, Representative Schultz had asked and brought up about why these bills are before us, and I think it really is getting to even what Chair Baker was identifying at the end about those businesses that are doing things right And we heard from testifiers being put at a competitive disadvantage. It's pretty rare that we have an opportunity to address a fraud and a harm that goes on those small businesses that are doing things right, and on government. I find these slides really compelling, and on workers. That's squarely within the work of this committee. And in particular, I think the part of the reason we're hearing this, Representative Greenman, please comment on this, is the hope that, I guess what I was hearing is that we do have a shared bipartisan interest in learning more about this. And so I think part of your hope in having this today is that we can work our way forward to having bipartisan support and eventually a bipartisan vote to actually begin to collect this information. Representative Greenman, final words on your bills.
Thank you. And for efficiency's sake, because we didn't have much time, we did both of these bills together, but they're two bills traveling separately, so with two different issues. And as we think about, and I just want to close, which is what we have been hearing in the fraud committee is that there's hundreds of workers, and we are talking about more, who are looking at that within DHS. There is, I think, a dozen or less folks doing enforcement in DLI. So when we look at the scope of the problem, we are actually not investing in it. And part of the reason is we don't have a number. We don't have $1 billion. We have these numbers from between 600 and $1 billion that we got from the outside. But we actually need these numbers to make sure that we are investing and we're getting a return on our investment, because this is money that is being stolen from taxpayers that should be going to UI, that should be going to workers' comp, that should be going to payroll taxes. With that, Mr. Chair, I would ask for folks' support, but I know we're laying it open.
Indeed. So members, House File 2146 is the reporting bill. That's the one that's been formally before us. So we've also talked about 2145, the penalties bill. So at this time, the chair does lay over House File 2146 as amended. House File 2145, I just want to make sure it gets brought before us. Representative Greenman moves House File 2145 to bring that before us. We had full discussion and testimony, and so the chair lays over that bill as well. Thank you, and then we'll have Representative Greenman, thank you. I know you're running off to another committee, and then I'll ask the folks from Deed to come up, House File 2440. Although my name is on the bill, it's on there because just in my role as chair of this committee, and so I think I'm going to stay in this position because it really is the department's bill as opposed to mine in that way. And I will ask, I'll put you on the spot, Chair Baker. I'll turn to Representative Berg again, if I can, to move House File 2440 to bring that before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do move House File 2440 to be before the committee.
Thank you. And then, members, there's an A25-0030 amendment, which takes 2440 was the department's proposed budget initially, and then there was a supplemental budget proposal that I believe is reflected in the A25-0030 with, I think Chair Baker is okay with adopting that to put in the form that the department wishes. Okay, so we'll have, Representative Berg, I'll ask you to move the A25-0030 amendment as well.
Mr. Chair, I move the A25-0030 amendment to put the bill in the order you would like.
Thank you so much. And members, again, this just brings it up to be the supplemental budget proposal. Any discussion? Not seeing any. All in favor of approval of the A25-0030 amendment, please say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay. So, Department, welcome. The bill is now in the form that you wish. Commissioner, so glad to have you. Please identify yourself and begin your testimony and presentation on the budget. And welcome to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Matt Verlich, and I serve as Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and I'm here to present the Governor's budget recommendations for our department. And I know you are under time constraints, so we'll try to move quickly.
Yes, and my apologies for that, but appreciate you understanding that. Thank you.
No worries. So, Mr. Chairman and members, the Governor's budget, as you've heard discussed before, reflects a responsible and measured approach to maintaining successful programs while also making targeted investments. That's true across the budget proposal for the enterprise and also true for Deed. Specifically, if we look at the general fund and workforce development fund net impacts, which we'll then go through in detail after this, you can see the general fund recommendation is a reduction on the order of $7.5 million in FY26, similar in FY27, and then a deeper reduction of $8.5 million in the out years. Workforce Development Fund, you can see, is a recommended increase, two components to that, which we will discuss as we move forward, but $13 million in the next biennium and $5 million beyond. First, one recommended new investment is the Service to Success Initiative. You can see the governor recommends $3 million per year in the first biennium and $500,000 per year after that for Service to Success. You can see a breakdown of how those dollars would be allocated, but let me in the next slide explain what this is about. There are a number of public service opportunities available to Minnesotans every year. Here we're sort of talking about non-military options. If you're looking for a non-military way to serve, those exist, and yet they lack a certain amount of coordination and awareness. Each of those, such as AmeriCorps, need to kind of market itself independently. So there is an opportunity, if we unify those a bit and help to elevate those opportunities, that we could get more people into them. And I would say, having been an AmeriCorps VISTA site when I was at the Initiative Foundation years ago, it is challenging in some cases to recruit folks to those opportunities. Also, those opportunities aren't necessarily as well connected to our workforce needs as they could be, and hence that's the connection to our department. And so by aligning them better, by connecting them to the needs of the workforce system under leadership of our Governor's Workforce Development Board team, along with MDE, we see an opportunity to help give more people an opportunity to serve and to meet the needs of our employers. Next, the Drive for Five Workforce Initiative. You can see a recommendation of an $8 million increase from the Workforce Development Fund. Drive for Five has been one of our flagship programs created in the FY, or rather in the 2023 session. And as you can see in the slide, it is a sectorally focused workforce development approach in which we make grants to a variety of partners to help bring more people into the pipeline in those sectors where there are family-sustaining wages available, high demand, et cetera. And the Drive for Five concept, I think, has been well received by those that have been involved in it. We have good results from it. It's also a bit of a unifying theme for the enterprise broadly, because we have, of course, other partner agencies, which we work with very well, who are also using their resources to steer people into those key sectors. And here you see a breakdown of how the funds would be used across workforce development organizations, trade associations, including chambers of commerce as well, and then an employer engagement team to provide additional assistance to certain employers who are hiring. Next, vocational rehabilitation services. You can see Governor recommending $5 million annually in all 4 years of the planning period from the Workforce Development Fund. VRS, just as a reminder, provides employment-related services to Minnesotans with disabilities to help them find and retain jobs, advance in their careers, and live well, live independently in their communities. As we've discussed with some of you, VRS is facing budget constraints due to increasing cost pressures, increasing demand, and also relatively flat funding, both from state and primarily federal sources. And so given the current trends and the dynamics there and increasing uncertainty about federal funds, additional support is needed to continue providing these critical services to help those individuals.
And I'll maybe just step in a note. I believe Chair Baker is going to be hosting a hearing when he's chairing tomorrow, where we'll be diving into somewhat more into these issues. So thank you. Please continue. Just want to highlight that for members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Next, an operations adjustment. Governor recommending $752,000 in FY26 and then $1.5 million in 27 through 29 to address cost increases. These relate to increases in employer-paid health care contributions, FICA, Medicare, IT costs, et cetera. To a large extent, these are outside our control. And in light of fiscal constraints, in fact, this amount wouldn't necessarily keep up with the increase in operating funds, and so we will be absorbing some of those costs. Next, moving on to budget-neutral recommendations. First, the Minnesota Forward Fund. Recall that this is the fund created in the 23 session to provide the state of Minnesota the opportunity to match large federal awards when Minnesota businesses were seeking them through IIJA, Inflation Reduction Act, et cetera. Those programs have served a very good purpose, now are being wound down to a large extent at the federal level, and yet we still have a robust pipeline of large-scale expansion projects in Minnesota for which a state contribution of an incentive is very meaningful and can help to make some of those big projects happen. So the governor is recommending that the FY24 appropriation be amended to, number one, be available until spent, and number two, remove the requirement that funds be used only as matching funds for those federal programs. And I think we're just providing additional supporting detail on the remainder of the slides, so I can move on there. I would just say that in this era in which we have had a larger capacity to invest in these kinds of projects, we have had really some great successes, which we'd love to walk through if anyone is interested. And so this change would enable us to continue driving some of those great expansions that provide wonderful employment opportunities for Minnesotans. Next, Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Program. As a reminder, this is a program in which we make grants to higher ed institutions to then do training that is very customized to an individual employer. It's highly successful. However, some of its provisions are a little bit in need of an update. And so this proposed change would allow larger maximum grant awards and allow training providers to request market rates, and ultimately would result in higher quality project proposals as well as greater demand for those programs. Again, they're very popular for those that are able to use them, but we see that there's an opportunity to do even more. Next, updating workforce program outcomes. The recommendation here is to modify the definition of credential to allow for non-post-secondary credentials under the workforce program's outcome statute. So basically, to give you all a better picture of what these programs are doing and to reflect the value of non-college credentials, in addition to college, but also to include things like coding boot camps, CDL, et cetera, because we know that, you know, the four-year college degree is not the only path that is useful and relevant for workers, and so we want to be supporting people in all those circumstances and have our reporting reflect that as well. Next, Greater Minnesota Business Development Public Infrastructure Program. A change recommended here in terms of eligibility to allow us to support plant-based processing. So as a reminder, this program gives us funding which we can use to support infrastructure in support of a particular business expansion project, and there are eligibility rules around what kinds of projects we can deploy these funds, and so this would allow us to do things like plant-based processing around corn, beans, sugar beets, and more. And then we move into funding changes in the reduction direction. So first, an overview of what I'm going to present in the following slides. You'll see all of the recommendations for the next 4 years. The reduction recommendations are calibrated so the programs are still able to provide value to their service populations, even though we have these reductions. The Economic Development Division is one that receives the greatest proportion of its general fund dollars compared with other divisions. So when you see where the reductions are, you're going to see a number of them that are in economic development. That's partly because that's where the general fund dollars are. Workforce development and workforce services, on the other hand, rely more on federal funds. And so now to talk through these reductions briefly and acknowledging that these are high-impact programs, valuable programs, but in order to recognize the fiscal circumstances we're in and meet the principles that the governor laid out in terms of a responsible and restrained budget, we are recommending the following changes of, as you can see, $3 million and then $2.4 million to the Job Creation Fund. Bless you to who sneezed. $750,000 reduction for the host communities impacting two communities, $1 million reduction for Small Business Assistance Partnership, which provides grants to nonprofits that do oftentimes culturally tailored entrepreneurship training, $500,000 reduction to the Emerging Entrepreneur Loan Program, $2.2 million, and then, $2.2 across all 4 years for BDPI, which we just talked about. I would note that in the bonding proposal, there is a recommended increase there to make up some of the reduction. $1 million reduction for redevelopment fund across the 4 years, and then $750,000 reduction for contamination cleanup. Then on to the next group of workforce development, where again, there aren't as many general fund dollars in play. Pathways to Prosperity, a $1 million reduction across the 4 years. And then finally, workforce services and transformation, individual placement and supports, which provides assistance to individuals with mental health challenges, a reduction of $1 million across the 4 years. And that concludes my presentation. We'd be happy to take any questions.
There we go. Thank you. I'm thinking if there are clarifying questions folks have, we could do them now, but otherwise we'll have discussion. I kind of think we maybe should hear from testifiers and all, and we can have discussion with members. And so what I'm inclined to do is bring up Lauren Bennett McGinty again to testify. You're the next testifier. Yeah, come on. Sorry, I didn't see you. I think you're listed as testifying, but perhaps you are not. I'm not sure. If you are, it sounds like you're just going to take a minute. So if you could just identify yourself again and then briefly provide your thoughts.
Thank you, Chair. And I am about to present some record lightning speed testimony here. So the Explore Minnesota base budget will be $17,023,000 plus an additional operating increase of $124,000 in fiscal year 251,000 in fiscal year 27, which puts our total for the biennium at $36,089,000. We are thankful for our budget and that it will remain stable in the coming biennium. With one-time funding we received in the last biennium, we worked to grow our asset library, collateral, staff, and build a framework to ensure that moving forward we could efficiently grow our impact. Recognizing the current budget situation, any amount of fiscal support is appreciated as we enter the new biennium. We will continue to find more efficiencies in our work to ensure our tourism marketing has a high impact and we can maintain and hopefully grow visitation in the coming years.
Thank you so much. And I'll just confirm for members and Director McGinty that the budget proposal for Explore Minnesota then is the base budget, is an operating adjustment, and there's no materials to back it up because we heard from you and that's sort of steady as she goes. Am I describing all that correctly?
Thank you, Chair. That is correct. It is $124,000 in FY26 and $251,000 in FY27.
Which is just an operating adjustment to kind of meet the needs as inflation, et cetera. So, okay. Thank you so much. And again, clarifying questions for Director McGinty, please. But otherwise, we'll move on to Sarah. And I'm not sure how to pronounce your last name, if you can make your way up. And I might ask Peggy Darmody as well to make your way up, or at least maybe you can sit in one of those back chairs to be ready to go. And then please identify yourself. Are you ready? And share your testimony, please. And I think we're asking folks to keep to 2 minutes if you can. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Sarah Nispel, Public Policy Coordinator at NAMI Minnesota. So NAMI Minnesota opposes the reduction of $1 million each year from the base for individual placement and supports. The reduction, along with one-time funding ending, would cut the only real employment program for people with serious mental illnesses in the state by more than half. IPS is the only employment program at DEED specifically for people with serious mental illnesses. People with mental illnesses have the highest unemployment rate among all categories of disability. Between 60 and 70% of people with a serious mental illness want to work, but only about 10% do. IPS is more accessible for the most marginalized members of our community, is more accessible than other employment programs. Unlike other programs, IPS providers don't wait to start a job search until their participants' symptoms have completely abated. IPS does not exclude participants based on diagnoses, substance use history, history of hospitalizations, homelessness, or legal system involvement. And perhaps most importantly, IPS integrates employment services with mental health services. Maybe someone's medication make it difficult to wake up early in the morning, so the team works together to change medications or to find a job that doesn't require an early start. And then they continue collaborating after participants land a job to help them through any rough patches along the way. Work is an evidence-based practice that supports mental health and substance use recovery. We support HF 1985, which would fund IPS at the level needed to maintain and begin expanding the program. The budget cuts in HF 2440 take us in the wrong direction. We urge you to oppose any cuts to this highly effective and underfunded program. Thanks.
Thanks for your testimony. Thanks for your advocacy for Minnesotans living with mental illness. Appreciate it. Thank you. And Peggy Darmody, if you can come up. I may have mispronounced your last name as well. My apologies if I did. But once you settle in, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Baker and Chair Pinto and members of the committee. My name is Peggy Darmody. I'm the Program Manager for Employment Services with GILD. I represent a coalition of 22 placement, individual placement and support, or IPS providers across Minnesota who help individuals with mental illness find and maintain employment. As providers, we partner with vocational rehabilitation services. IPS is the most effective model for helping people with mental illness achieve competitive employment. In your packet are two documents which provide more in-depth information and background about IPS. IPS has a placement rate of 63%, which is higher than the national average of 45%, and higher than the placement rate of other vocational programs, which is around 25%. So thank you for the opportunity to testify today in opposition of the governor's budget recommendation to reduce the base of IPS. Okay. This reduction will cut an additional $1 million per year and will have devastating consequences. If enacted, this reduction, along with the loss of temporary increase granted in 2023, will force IPS programs to scale back services drastically. As a result, 22 IPS providers in Minnesota, which currently support 1,100 individuals, will be forced to reduce their capacity by 70%. This means 770 people will lose access to the critical support they need to find and keep jobs. Furthermore, the viability of IPS programs across the state will be in jeopardy, with many providers unable to sustain operations under these cuts. So on behalf of the 22 IPS providers across Minnesota and the thousands of individuals who rely on these services, I urge you to reconsider these budget reductions and restore full funding to IPS. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Armitage. Thanks for your testimony. Thanks for your work as well. Are there other members of the public who wish to testify on this bill as amended? Okay, so we'll close testimony. So members, moving to questions and comments. I will maybe note just one thing that was striking me is that the structure of our budget process means the administration sort of they have to go first to fit spending within a particular target. We will be going through that exercise ourselves in a couple weeks, or even sooner, I suppose. Kind of the administration is showing their hand and saying some places where they believe there should be increases and cuts, et cetera, and these are things for us to consider. In any case, members, questions, comments at all? Oh, Representative Baker, pardon me. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Bear-Elect. Just clarifying question for you. So on slide 9, you talked about the governor recommendation of an increase to address operating increases at Deed. Can you clarify what that exactly is?
Commissioner Bear-Elect.
Mr. Chair, Representative, items listed here, including some instances where we pay other entities in the enterprise for some of these basic items related to, our employees and our IT services, et cetera.
Representative Baker.
So am I right to assume staffing and the operating costs associated with just running the agency?
Yeah. Commissioner?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes.
Representative Baker.
Can you point out for me in the reductions where Deed has proposed reductions in staffing levels within the different reductions that you have toward the end of your presentation?
Commissioner. So, okay, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't know that we have proposed reducing people, but the budget decisions that are made will have implications that ultimately could impact our people.
Representative Baker.
So just to clarify, Deed is, and I think this is a bigger concern across multiple agencies. We're seeing the organizations that, and we heard testifiers from NAMI and from Guild talk about the impact on their organizations. But my disappointment is that we're not seeing a reduction in FTEs at the state level. And that's why I asked that question. So what I would what I would encourage, whether it be DEED or DALI or MDE, when we hear these bills, these recommendations, and I appreciate the chair bringing up that this is a starting point in the conversation, but the reality of it is organizations across our state, whether it be the ones that testified today, NAMI, GILD, or our school districts, our counties, we are going to be making significant staffing reductions. And frankly, it is completely out of touch with reality when our state-run organizations come, our departments come and say, you know, we're going to keep our staffing levels where they're at. So I'll end it with that.
And Commissioner, you're welcome to comment on that if you'd like. Commissioner?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, Representative. My answer is about the sequencing of the process. And so we acknowledge that depending on what budget levels are set, that that would have impacts on our staff as well as on grant making, et cetera. So that will be part of the equation, but we are not leading with that piece necessarily.
Okay. Representative Baker, okay. Anything else from members? Oh, Representative Baker, pardon me, yeah.
And unfortunately, and I might be a little raw with this because, you know, just recently I had to tell employees that they don't have a job next year. So it is extremely frustrating, and whether it's DEED, DALI, MDE, when we're going to just continue down this path in growing the different agencies, and the people that the agencies support are being are having to cut. So I'll stop with that.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Baker. Anyone else, questions, comments? Mr. Chair, Chair Baker.
Thank you. Just real briefly, I know that you're under a crunch time here, Mr. Chair, but thank you, Commissioner, for bringing this forward again. I think we're going to have a lot of conversation tomorrow about VRS services, about the dramatic switch and the changes in that direction and that momentum, really, that was going on, and for a better understanding about what happened there. So I just want to tee that up for tomorrow a little bit, members. But again, I think it's the same kind of the concerns that Representative Bakeberg brought up. We are facing some real challenges out in the workforce. We need to make sure that this budget also tightens the belt around agency sizes and FTEs, because there was a lot of new people hired in a lot of agencies in the last couple of years. So this is a time we need to tighten our belts. I also just want to be on record to say, I don't say this very often, I supported what the governor made a decision with to do yesterday to bring people back to work. And again, I say that because of the businesses in St. Paul really need them here. That's a big, big part of that. So again, I appreciate that foresight on that, to kind of look at our empty buildings, to kind of see we do better collaborations. And again, it's not that often, but I do appreciate that movement in the state, you know, employee world. And I know this is part of the workforce stuff, and it's really not part of this budget necessarily, but I just wanted to go on record to say I think that was a bold decision. It was a good decision. I support it, and I just wanted to put it on record, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Not seeing any other discussion. I guess, Commissioner, we'll give you, in the role of the equivalent bill author, we'll give you final words on your budget and continued conversation. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and Representative Baker as well. Thank you for the comments, and again, would acknowledge that the fiscal environment is such that we have to make some hard choices on the subject of vocational rehabilitation services. I know you're going to talk about that in more detail. And to the topic we had just a moment ago, there are staff impacts already in that instance. And so we are not immune to budgetary limitations, and we're trying to blunt them. We certainly honor the service of all our employees, even as we operate through these fiscal times that we're in.
Commissioner, thank you to you and your whole team for all of your work. Appreciate it. And I do know the VRS issue will be discussed further tomorrow, but thank you for being here. So with that, the chair lays over House File 2440 as amended for consideration at a later date. Thank you so much. I'll ask the DLI folks to head on up. Representative Berg, I'll ask you to move House File 2441 to bring that before us. Thank you for helping with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 2441 to be before the committee.
Thank you so much. And I don't believe that there is an amendment to that. And so, Commissioner, welcome to you, second commissioner of the morning. And once you're ready, we'll have you simply dive in and begin to present your budget proposal that's in the form of House File 2441. Welcome. Looks like the presentation's beginning to work here. So, yeah, please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nicole Blissenbach, and I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you for the opportunity to present the governor's proposed budget for the department and to testify in support of House File 2441. So the governor's budget for the Department of Labor and Industry includes a number of items that are up on the screen. I know we are short on time, so I'm going to try to keep things pretty short so there are time if there's questions. But also I wanted to point the members of the committee that much of this material is in your packet, including some additional information sheets on some of our proposed items. So just draw your attention there.
Thank you.
So I'm going to jump right in. The first item in the proposed budget, it relates to our construction codes and licensing fee alignment. So this proposal is a recommendation to align fees related to permits, inspections, and plan review within six units in DLI's construction codes and licensing division. And really that alignment is to make those fees align with the cost of providing service and to for the department to be able to continue the current level of service that we provide in these areas. Construction codes and licensing services are funded exclusively by revenue that is generated from these fees. And currently the fees assessed are inadequate to fund the costs of providing the services. Most of the fees that we are touching have not seen an increase since 2007. I do want to draw members' attention to letters that have been submitted in support of this provision of the budget. In the packets, you have letters in support from the IBEW State Council and NECA, MMCA and the Minnesota Pipe Trades Association, Housing First, the Minnesota State Building and Construction Trades Council, the International Union of Elevator Constructors, Local 9, the Board of Electricity, and the Electrical Association. There is also a summary of the proposal in your packets. So the next slide goes into those. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but it does go into the details about the changes in fees for electrical permits, for plumbing plan review and permit fees. And then on the next slide, the changes for manufactured structures, boiler inspection fees, and elevator inspection fees. I do also want to note that the department is working very closely with the Manufactured and Modular Home Association, MMHA, to address the concerns that they have raised, and we really appreciate the conversations we have had, and we are optimistic that we will continue to work with them and hopefully reach a place of agreement related to the specific fees for manufactured structures. Next in the proposal is a proposal for additional misclassification enforcement funding. So this would fund an additional 2.5 full-time equivalent employees for the department's labor standards division. I should note that when the misclassification policy bill moved last year, we were provided with $70,000 for misclassification enforcement. That does not support a full-time person, so when we bring up issues related to the department's ability to fully address misclassification, one of our issues is that we need the staff in order to do the enforcement. We did not propose that increase last year because it wasn't a budget year, and we waited, and now the proposal is for an additional 2.5 FTEs. This slide you have seen before when we came to the committee to talk about the partnership and the what's happening in the partnership. I just wanted to flag that we have 26 more intakes in the past 7 months than in all of 2023 related to misclassification. It's not just construction. We've seen this in mental health and substance abuse centers, healthcare, construction, transportation, restaurant, and food services. So we're seeing this problem more than just in the construction industry, and we need more resources to address it. The next proposal is a statewide registered teacher apprenticeship. So we at the department are the state registered apprenticeship authority. Apprenticeship is a tested method that has been successful for almost 100 years in Minnesota. I know you've heard a lot about apprenticeship, and we appreciate Representative Mueller's lead on this as well. But the proposal we have in the governor's budget is $5 million in fiscal year 26 and $2 million in fiscal year 27 from the Workforce Development Fund to support the establishment of a statewide registered apprenticeship program for teachers. Funds will be directed to a labor entity representing educators and can be used for a number of different purposes, including operationalizing and administering the program, designing related instruction, purchasing training materials and apprenticeship tracking systems, recruiting signatory school districts, journey worker teachers and apprentices, and providing sub-awards for signatory school districts. There are a number of slides following this that talk in more depth about apprenticeship and what it is required. There are statutes and regulations both at the federal level and the state level that that cover apprenticeship when it is registered with the state of Minnesota. So I'm not going to spend a ton of time going into those details because I know we are short.
Well, and also note, so I believe Representative Mueller's bill will be up tomorrow, and so it may well be, I guess, sort of be prepared, DLI, we may, or Mr. Moore, we may end up calling you up to sort of highlight some of this to understand Representative Mueller's bill, et cetera. So just making connections among different things. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And the Director of Apprenticeship at the department will be here tomorrow if there are additional questions.
Even better. Okay, good. Thank you much.
The next item in the budget proposal is an operating adjustment. We have a general fund operating adjustment. If folks remember back from my agency overview, only about 6% of the department's budget comes from general fund money. So this is an operating adjustment related to our general fund appropriation. We also have in the budget proposal a operating adjustment related to the workers' compensation fund. I will note that we have discussed this proposal with members of the Work Comp Advisory Council, and we have not heard any concerns, primarily because we do not believe that this proposal will impact the assessment on insurers that is what funds the work comp fund.
I might just ask as a clarifying question on this slide, are these two columns, the general fund and workforce compensation fund, are they independent such that, you know, we could choose to do one and not the other? Do they travel together, if you understand my question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that question. They are independent in the proposal.
Okay, thank you.
All right, the next item on the proposal is an item strengthening mandatory break laws. So the governor recommends updating Minnesota work and meal break laws, or rest and meal break laws, to clarify what they are. So current rest break language requires adequate time to use the nearest restroom for every 4 consecutive hours worked. So the proposal, what the proposal does is provide some clarity to that and says that they updates rest breaks to be 15 minutes or enough time to use the restroom for every 4 consecutive hours worked. Most employers do provide 15-minute breaks, so this isn't, we haven't heard much opposition to this because this is what is provided typically. Current meal break requires sufficient time to eat a meal for every 8 consecutive hours worked. The proposal updates meal breaks to require 30-minute meal breaks for every 6 hours worked. Again, this is not unheard of. Most employers do provide 30-minute meal breaks because if they provide less than 30 minutes, then it is required to be paid. If they provide more than 30 minutes of duty-free time, it is not required to be paid. So that is an update to that. The reason this falls in the budget proposal and not a policy proposal is because along with this, there are some penalty revisions that would allow for potential penalty revenue if the law is not followed. The next item in the budget is new in the governor's revised budget, and these are grants to certified worker organizations. The governor recommends $1 million in fiscal year 26 from the general fund to the department for grants to certified worker organizations. These grants would support these organizations in training nursing home workers regarding the provisions of the law related to the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board and the rules and laws that apply.
And this, and Commissioner and members, this is a bill that we heard from Representative Ibaje, I believe it was last week.
Yes, correct? That is correct.
Okay, Chair. Good. Making the connections. Thanks.
All Right. Once the way this grant would work is once an entity is approved as a certified worker organization by the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board, they could apply to the department for a grant to support the work that they will be doing in training nursing home workers around the state. And I believe the final item, yes, the final item in the proposed budget is an extension of money that was already appropriated to the department to conduct a report or a study and issue a report related to single egress stairways. This budget recommendation is neutral. We were tasked with evaluating the conditions under which apartment buildings of a certain height with a single means of egress achieve safety outcomes equal or superior to current code. And this report is due on December 31st of 2025, but the money that we were appropriated would cancel before that date. We are just asking that that money be extended so that we can complete the study and use the money to pay for it. So I think that brings me to the end, and I am happy to address any questions.
Thank you so much. Unless there are clarifying questions, we'll save questions for a little bit later. Caitlin Snyder, please head up. We'll have Mark Bruner be ready to go, and we're asking folks to keep things to 2 minutes if you can. And Ms. Snyder, welcome, and please identify yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chairs, my name is Caitlin Snyder, representing Education Minnesota. We represent 84,000 educators across the state. I'd like to thank the governor for his proposal for a registered teacher apprenticeship program. This is fairly new to teachers, this registered apprenticeship program, but this is the model that's being used in Washington and Oregon. Like all other professions, we have a recruitment and retention problem, but it's about 20% recruitment and it's 80% retention. And this proposal is really aimed at that issue. This will be an economic boon to people that are already working in our schools. It will increase their pay, their pensions, their health care. We'll take people that are already in schools and give them the opportunity to be leading a classroom themselves. In terms of recruitment, the more prepared a teacher is, the longer they stay. In some cases, when teachers are not fully prepared to enter the classroom, we have a higher attrition rate than nurses, which is not good. So this model, this three-year program of on-the-job training, education is embedded in their programming. This is a really great model for preparing the best educators for our students. In the other body, there were two districts who testified in support. I will not speak for them, but I wanted that on the record. And Education Minnesota has a formal partnership with Black Men Teach and CDF Freedom Schools. This is a large ask in front of the committee, but it's a larger need across the state. So I am excited to be here today as well as tomorrow to talk about this issue. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much for your testimony and for being here. And so, Mark Bruner, you're next, and then Mr. Saint-Cartier. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing your last name correctly, but Mr. Bruner, please identify yourself. Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark Bruner, the Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. We represent nearly 1,000 privately owned manufactured home communities in the state of Minnesota that have about 50,000 home sites. We also represent the builders of manufactured and modular homes, as well as lenders and service and supplier companies. The Department of Labor and Industry is our primary regulator, and I think this is the first time in 10 years I've ever actually addressed the committee on their budget bill and had questions or concerns, but we are making progress and working through most all the issues that I've addressed in my letter to the committee ahead of time. So just briefly to cover some of the topics, we are supportive of increasing the installation seal fee from $80 to $130. It hasn't been increased for a number of years. The department is sort of a fee-for-service type funded organization, so that's certainly necessary. regarding a proposed shipment label fee of $75 for homes built in plants before they leave, have a shipment fee label put on them or shipped in from other states. We've talked to the department about that, and for reasons involving federal preemption of our building code and interstate commerce issues, they're backing away from advancing that proposal, which we appreciate. One of the primary concerns we still have, and we're trying to work through this, is this used home decal that would go on any manufactured home that's listed for sale, whether it's on private property, which is where 85% of homes we sell today go, or those in a manufactured home community. Currently in statute, anyone that sells a used manufactured home completes a compliance form. It's a 9-point checklist, smoke detectors, CO detectors, those kinds of things, egress windows. It's negotiated between the buyer and the seller who makes those repairs. What the change does is really makes this sort of a requirement. Before you sell a home, there'd have to be additional inspections. And concerns we have are the availability of these decals. Somebody has to move, sell their home. How do you get a decal and inspection? You know, no other homes or housing types require this type of inspection. Single family homes don't. It's sort of unique. Our concern is with the nearly 100,000 homeowners in the state that would be affected anytime they sell their home. How are they going to know about the requirement? Will it cloud a title transfer if there's a mortgage involved? So we're making progress on that. We understand that this is important to the department in that meeting their budget requirements that is part of their fee for service kind of thing. So. Hopefully, we'll continue to make progress on that. A couple other points.
I'll say we're at the 3-minute, actually well past the 3-minute mark, I'm afraid. If you can just kind of wrap it up, if you can. Yeah.
We're working on the bill changed the definition of a manufactured home, a sales center, dealer, retailer, and is adding in anyone who leases a home. And hopefully we can correct that, because anyone who leases a manufactured home, it could conceivably require a licensure of hundreds of businesses. Yeah. And I think that's an unintended provision in the bill. And the other is just changing penalties from a state-based $1,000 unit to referencing a federal code, which is both civil and criminal in terms of its application. So we're working on those points, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to hear that the progress is being made on that. And thanks for your testimony and your work. So for our final testifier, then. And please identify yourself once you get settled in and proceed.
Chair Pinto, good job on the name. Chair Baker.
Oh, good to see excellent. You good.
Yep, committee members. I'm Ryan St. Cartier, Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Contractors of the National Electrical Contractor Association and the Minnesota Mechanical Contractor Association. At Minnesota NECA and MMCA, we represent over 250 contractors who specialize in installation and maintenance of electrical, plumbing, heating, and cooling systems. Our members range from small businesses with just a few employees to large companies. With hundreds, they take on construction and maintenance projects of all sizes, residential, commercial, and industrial sectors. On behalf of both associations, I'm here to voice support specifically for the Department of Labor and Industry Construction Code and Licensing Division fee alignment and the adoption of Class 4 circuit technology into the Power Limited license, which they didn't highlight, but is, of course, very important to my electrical contractors. It has been nearly 20 years since most of the licensing fees have been adjusted. Due to this, fees no longer align with the cost of services provided to contractors. This has led to an operational deficit in the Construction Code and Licensing Division. This operational deficit has created barriers for the division to accommodate a growing number of construction projects and inflationary cost pressures, resulting in plan review and inspection service delays that impact our industry's ability to build on expected timelines. This harms contractors, workers, building owners, and consumers alike. This fee alignment will help our industry complete projects faster and therefore, in many cases, lower costs for my contractors and our customers. Class 4 circuits, on the other hand, are an emerging technology in the electrical industry that is not currently listed under the Power Limited Technician License. Class 4 systems bring a safer, more affordable wiring solution for high power applications. My electrical contractors are eager to embrace this new technology through its adoption into the Power Limited License, as it benefits to the electrical industry and to the public are apparent. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your testimony, and I'll point our members' attention to the joint letter from Mechanical Contract Association of the Pipe Trades in support of the bill, in support of the fee increases. Appreciate it. Any other members of the public wish to testify on the bill? Not seeing any, so we'll close testimony. And I think Chair Baker is the only one on the list so far. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and I have a question for the Commissioner. Yes, thank you, Commissioner, for coming back up. On your bill this year, page 47 of the break laws, you had mentioned about that. I've got a lot of concern about where sort of some of this language came from. There's more penalties in here for folks, and I'm just maybe more specifically to lines 47.6. What does it mean when it says, or to otherwise be relieved from work duties? I don't know what that means.
Commissioner Blissenbach. She may need to phone a friend, not sure. Yeah, but Commissioner, she's getting a copy of the bill, maybe. Language. Okay. Thank you. I think it was 47.6.
I guess I just, you know, as you look for that too, I can just say, Mr. Chair, I mean, there's a lot of places where you just can't kind of like punch out or take a break without interruptions because of the nature of the work. You know, it could be hospitality, could be emergency responders. What does that line mean, though, for or to otherwise be relieved from work duties?
Commissioner Blissenbach.
Chair Pinto and Chair Baker, what a line were you pointing to again? I'm sorry.
And Commissioner, it's 47.6, Commissioner.
Under the break clause.
It says under break clause, it says, or to otherwise be relieved from work duties is where Chair Baker is pointing to, at line 47.6. Commissioner, please.
Yes, Chair Pinto and Chair Baker. So that is just saying that the break time could be used to use the restroom. It could also be used for a break.
Chair Baker.
Or otherwise to be relieved from work duties. Okay, I'm just not sure why that was added. We can talk about that later, Mr. Chair. It's going to be laid over.
Yep.
And maybe just my more overarching question about, again, the penalties of breaks is alarming to me. Again, we're not making it easier in Minnesota to do business. More penalties are being looked at. If we have a problem with employers, again, we spent a lot of time on wage theft issues and bad actors back in 2019 when then Representative Mahoney and I and others worked on a very bipartisan bill to make sure the wage theft stuff was covered. This is sort of under that umbrella, in my opinion. There was a lot of money put aside for inspectors, for people to kind of make sure that we follow up on these kind of complaints. You mentioned earlier today that you received $70,000 last year for this independent contractor discussion. It still kind of follows under the overall arching responsibility of the Department of Labor to make sure that we find those bad actors that are taking advantage of our workers. I'm shocked that it seems like there is no money for enforcements. Help me understand with the 2019 law that was worked for, and again, ended up to be very bipartisan, why is it today it sounds like there's no resources, there's no money to put people in the field or to follow up on these kind of critical items that we're talking about? That concerns me. I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair and Chair Baker. I thank you for that question. In 2019, and I joined the department in 2019 and helped kind of lead up the implementation of the wage theft law, and thank you for leadership on that. We were able to add to our resources specifically related to wage theft, and I think I reported in our agency overview in 2024, the department assessed more than $5 million in unpaid wages and liquidated damages for workers who were the victims of wage theft. We have been making significant strides in that area, both related to wage theft, child labor, but there is more work than we can do, which is why we appreciate the partnership at the Attorney General's office, who also does much of this work. But even with the additional resources, we don't take every case that comes in to the department. We can't. We don't have the resources. But I will point out this budget proposal doesn't ask for additional resources for that. The only additional FTE asks is related to misclassification enforcement, that 2.5 FTE. We do think that that is necessary to at least kind of meet the rising need and the number of complaints we're receiving within the department. Also, our authority with the misclassification bill last year was expanded. So we have, where we didn't have the mechanisms to enforce misclassification laws that were effective for outside the construction industry prior to the misclassification bill now, we do have the mechanism to do that. So we need the people in order to then utilize the mechanism in order to have an impact on the industries where we are seeing an increase in those issues.
Chair Baker.
And just finals, yeah. Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
And again, you've got a lot of FTEs under your agency and you're under your umbrella. We have seen a real expansion of in the field inspectors again for the building side of things. And again, I think from 2016, we went from about 12 to 14 people up to 60 people now for inspectors around the state. I think that's more on the electrical side. I think there was a shift. My question is, it's nice that I'm hearing good reports that you guys are getting good turnaround. You've got increasing fees here for that reason. Hasn't been done for a while. I'm struggling with that. But my concern is, we talk about misclassification. We talk about wage theft. Can you start thinking about shifting some of those people over this way a little bit, or maybe other people? Because what we don't have, it might take a couple more days to get back to our inspection turnarounds, but we really do have a fire burning on the other side to help make sure that we are focusing in on wage theft and the bad players. I just say that as a comment because you get to control sort of how you allocate those funds in the department. So I know we got to keep moving, Mr. Chair, but I hope that we can find the resources that we are currently spending and investing in to make sure that the rules that have been passed are going to be enforced. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Baker. And what I think I may do, Commissioner, is let you respond to that as part of closing on this your budget proposal. So please provide thoughts on both those points. Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. The response I have to that is we do have restrictions on what we can use the construction codes and licensing fund to do. We have restrictions on the work comp fund can be used for certain purposes. And much of the money we get from the general fund is allocated to the department for specific things. As well. So there are some restrictions in the ability for us to utilize certain fund sources for work that is outside the description. So to answer that just in general. So I think this budget was very well thought out. I appreciate the work of the staff at the department, especially as it relates to the fee realignment for construction codes and licensing. A lot of analysis went in to make sure the fees that are related to certain things are the ones that we're increasing in order to pay for those specific functions that the department does. And I just appreciate the work of the department and look forward to continued discussions. Thank you.
And thank you, Commissioner. Thanks to your whole team for all of your work. And, yeah, it is notable to me that just the breadth of support for the fee increases. Sounds like the one group that expressed concerns, which we heard from Mr. Bruner, there's very constructive conversations going on. So thank you for that. Thanks for your testimony. With that, the chair lays over House File 2441 for possible consideration of your date. We're at least going to squeeze in Representative Lee's bill, so that is House File 2565, I believe, yes. And so Representative Berger, I might ask you again, tell me out to move House File 2565 to be before us.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move House File 2565 to be before the committee.
And then there's a DE1, if you could move the DE1 amendment, Representative Berg.
Mr. Chair, I move the DE1.
Thank you. And members, Representative Lee, my understanding is the original bill was an appropriation. The DE1 will just turn the appropriation into an extension of a current appropriation, so no fiscal impact in that way. Is that correct, Representative Lee?
That's correct, Chair.
Okay, excellent. And so, members, any discussion to the DE1? Hearing none, all in favor of approval of DE1, please say aye. Aye. Any opposed? That passes. And so, Representative Lee, we have obviously very limited time, but if you can describe your bill, and we'll hear quickly from your testifiers.
Great. Thank you, Chair and members. So with the delete everything amendment that you just adopted, the request from Ramsey County in House File 2565 is now just to extend the availability of funds that were appropriated in 2023. Passing out this extension today to the General Register would allow the county to be able to hold a program for this summer for youth 18 to 24, and it gives them certainty because it takes them months to recruit and plan for hopefully will be a June 2025 cohort. So I know we have a limited time, so I just want to make sure that I give some time to Ms. Gaywa here, who was the beneficiary, and we have Director Catrice O'Neill here if there are questions.
Thanks. All right, so we'll hear from our testifier, and just in case there's questions, we'll hear from Ms. O'Neill. So welcome to you. Please identify yourself and share your testimony with us.
Good morning. My name is Gaywa, and I am a graduate from
the Ramsey County Tax Cloud Training Program. I learned about this program through an email which I sent out by Matt, and I was told that the program offers an education in IT at St. Paul College and also an internship opportunity afterward. And during those time, I also like get a stipend. And at first, I was scammed at first, but it was a great opportunity. And this program offers opportunity of education and internship at no cost for my pockets. And it was greatly helpful to the stipend because it was helpful with paying for my transportation and daily necessity. And it is thanks to this program that I was able to gain a work experience. And those are also not the only support, but they also help with like job search and interview preparation and also resume building. And thanks to this, I am now working full time as a technician at Minnesota Tech for Success.
Excellent. Thank you so much. We need your skills. Some of us need your skills, those skills more than others, so thank you. So anybody else wish to testify on the bill, and members of the public, so hearing none. Member questions or discussions regarding the bill? And not seeing any. I'll note again that I think it took some time for the appropriation for the funds to make it to Ramsey County, and there's this concern that the funds were to expire, you wouldn't be able to offer a program this summer, which is why the plan is to send this to the General Register, and appreciate Chair Baker's agreement with that. So not hearing anything else, so Representative Lee will give you final word on your bill, as always.
Sure. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair Bakers, for agreeing to, you know, make sure that we make this right and allow the county to continue this program this summer.
Excellent. So with that, Representative Berg renews her motion that House File 2565, as amended, be recommended for placement on the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Motion passes. Congratulations, Representative Lee. Thank you so much to our testifier and to the county for your work. And we have had Representative Kozlowski's testifier was available on Zoom. Want to make sure that we have time to hear that proposal another date. We're now at our time at 10 a.m. We knew that this was going to be something that we weren't quite sure if we could squeeze things in. And so we'll look to do that another time. And my apologies. I guess please then save. You can put it into save material in your packet for that bill. We would appreciate that. With that, and then, Mr. Chair, we've talked a little bit about tomorrow, but anything else you want to add?
Not really much. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tomorrow, again, we'll have the deed policy bill, I believe, tomorrow, as well as the deeper dive into the vocational rehab services. There's a lot of information that's coming forward. So with that, a few other bills, and that'll be it for an action-packed day tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one of which is that teacher apprenticeship bill. So, Representative Schultz, you have something you want to say?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Oh, is your microphone on?
The testifier for 1506 is here today, and I happen to know is a resident of Duluth. So I don't know if you mentioned someone virtual. So I just want to make sure that in the case of someone who traveled multiple hours to be here.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if we have that flexibility.
Well, Representative Schultz, I hadn't realized there was somebody physically here. I mean, I'm okay going for a couple more minutes, but I want to – sounds like Representative Chair Baker is as well. So for those – we have a quorum. If folks need to leave, they can leave. So come on up. Okay, that's great. Yeah. No, I did not realize somebody was here in person, Representative Schultz. With that, Representative Kozlowski – moves House File 1506 to be before us. So saved by Representative Schultz, Representative Kozlowski. Good call.
Thank you,
Representative Schultz, for that. I see no amendment, and so Representative Kozlowski, please present your bill.
Chair Pinto, Representative Schultz, I appreciate that. I was looking at my text message and saw he didn't log in.
Oh,
right here.
Okay.
Well, to our committee, thank you for the opportunity to move House File 1506 and present this quickly. This is a bill for the critical work that is supported by Entrepreneur Fund, which is a trusted and dynamic partner in our community and fostering economic growth in 16 different counties as well as 5 Native nations. So, without further ado, and given the really short time crunch, I'm just going to turn it over to my testifier to share more.
Thank you. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Hi, Chair Pinto, Chair Baker, thank you. Sean Wellness, I'm the CEO of the Entrepreneur Fund. I want to thank author Kozlowski and co-authors Scraba and Johnson's, Lesnikar, and IGO. Thank you very much for the support. I'll keep this brief. The Entrepreneur Fund, we are, this bill would allow $1 million in revolving loan fund capital to the Entrepreneur Fund that we would leverage multiple times to lend out to communities in our central and northeast Minnesota region. Real briefly, why it's important, while you talk to any business owner, I know there's many here, first thing you often hear from them, what's your biggest need? And they'll say access to capital. And Entrepreneur Fund plays a unique role. We provide access to opportunities where markets don't serve well. So startup businesses, Main Street communities, we tend to be a catalyst where we will do a loan in a project, get it up and going, and the private market will take us out shortly afterwards. To do that work, we need capital to lend out. As you can kind of look forward in your budget forecast and your business, you can see an economic recession is likely on the horizon, which means credit markets will constrain and access for our capital will be needed going forward. So we're seeking, as part of this bill, it's a $1 million support. With that, we will multiply it with at least $3 of private or federal matching funds that come with that. Historically, we've been able to do much more than that. And for many of you in your communities, Duluth, and if you've ever been to the wonderful Duluth-Lincoln Park Craft District, for example, you can drive through there, and 29 of those businesses had to get access to capital to get their projects going. So thank you for your time and consideration, and I'll open for questions.
Thank you so much. I'm being advised we will need to leave sort of any second here. Anybody else in the public wish to testify? Not seeing any. Member discussions or questions, better be fast. Not seeing any. Representative Kozlowski, will let you close on your bill. And my apologies, so tight, but I'm glad we fit in. Representative Kozlowski.
No, it's short and sweet. We appreciate it. But in investing in this, I mean, you hand out in your packet, you can see the businesses that were supported. This is a good investment. They punch above their weight. I hope you consider this in our omnibus bill.
Thank you so much, Representative Kozlowski. Thank you, sir, for being here. My apologies for the confusion. With that, the chair lays over House File 1506 for possible future consideration. With that, we are adjourned.